I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. North Koreans specifically have been kicking up the dirt a little bit. I know both of you have written extensively on them this week. Austin, you talked a little bit about the shots that they traded with each other. What's going on there?
Well, Dan, after 2010, the two bloody incidents in 2010, just to review them, March 2010, the South Korean Navy Corvette Chonan was sunk, and actually the disputed boundary waters along the northern limit line. It's just to the west of the peninsula. Think about where Incheon is and Seoul, and go west and slightly north, and that's where the northern limit line supposedly dividing the maritime boundary between North and South Korea exists. But this South Korean Corvette was sunk in March of 2010. 46 sailors died. And I sidebar on this. When I was in South Korea in fall of 2010, there was a memorial for them at the military museum there in Seoul. And most of these sailors were, you know, teens, early 20s, young people who were in the South Korean Navy. They had pictures of all the dead there on this display. It was after a lot of investigation, and Strategy Page had a lot of material on this. I wrote several columns. Jim wrote extensively about it. But a team of international forensics experts, tech investigators, and the like pinned it down that was most likely, and, well, heavens, of course, was a North Korean sneak attack torpedo to sink this ship. A total belligerent act. Attacking somebody else's Navy ship and sinking it and killing a substantial portion of its crew. Then the second incident was in November 2010. I butcher this. I've heard it pronounced correctly at least three dozen times, but I'll blow it again. Yongpyong Island, that's one of the islands out there near the northern limit line. You can still see on the web some of the video of the North Korean shelling of Yongpyong. Four South Korean citizens were killed. I don't remember the number wounded, but one of the still photos that was dramatically indicative of how bad it was shows shells landing on a grocery store there on the island. And what comes out of this is the South Koreans, who had already vastly rolled back the sunshine policy, when the sunshine policy was, we're going to change or North Korea by offering carrots, economic carrots and the like, and aid. There's still elements of it, but in play to try to take care of some of the worst cases of starvation in North Korea. But we're going to shoot back, is what the South Korean government told North Korea. You guys pull off an attack. We don't care where it is, on the land, sea, air, or what, and we're going to shoot back at you. And there's been kind of a shadow game with this. North Korea a couple of times has launched some shorter range missiles, but they've been in pretty controlled circumstances. But this time, North Korea, after pumping 500 artillery and rocket rounds into the disputed sea zone, remember, Dan, all of them landed in the water. South Korea pumped a little over 300 artillery rounds, and based on what I've seen, yeah, it was all tube artillery. The picture the South Korean government gave the press showed a bunch of 155 self-propelled artillery pieces firing, so I'm assuming it's 155. Now, so there was a South Korea shooting back. Very structured shootback, though, in part because prior to the North Korean live fire exercise, which is what Pyongyang called it, there was a phone call on a naval hotline that connects North Korea to South Korea and said, we are going to conduct a live fire exercise in this area. And South Korea, I've heard two versions of this, but one out of one of the South Korean dailies said that it was time for the civilians on the islands, including Yongpyeong, and then another one very near it, to get into bunkers. And South Korea retaliated. Very careful retaliation, and actually it was a very rather surprisingly careful provocation from North Korea. As a matter of fact, one of the South Korean newspapers said it was unprecedented, and then I later found when I'm reading a South Korean government's official, not named, saying this was highly unusual. So I'm guessing that's where the South Korean press got that statement. That was highly unusual for us to receive an alert like that. Well, South Korean diplomats said it was because North Korea didn't want political blowback from more civilian casualties. I don't think that's the entire story, because that's never stopped them before. I think they know that South Korea is going to shoot back. And South Korea, what I suggested in my column, this is not just me that has said this, at some point South Korea and Japan, United States possibly as well in this, are going to be faced with a situation where they're going to have to make a choice about taking out North Korean nuclear facilities. And what may precipitate it is a North Korean provocation of a type. And what I suggested in the article was that this is the same old, with a slightly new riff of rationality on the part of the North Korean government. It was a test in their case as well. South Korea, and Jim, I'll let Jim take off on this. South Korea's devoted a lot of time and money to modernizing their military, and the Japanese have a pretty competent small military force, which they're now talking about expanding. Dan, after Crimea, I think there are folks in Pyongyang that think, hey, sometime that's going to be us recovering our lost half of our country on their part. But and I think the South Koreans think, no, not on our watch. So anyway, that's kind of the gist of the column, but that's the historical background for this week's incident.
Right. Jim, your piece this week covered a lot of different things that are going on in North Korea. It's almost just a laundry list of a child acting badly. I know the Chinese are trying to deal with them still. How's that going for them?
Well, the Chinese did achieve something of a coup last week. They hosted talks between Japan and North Korea. That's the first time that happened since 2009. The Japanese had cut off foreign aid. Again, as Austin pointed out, something that the North Koreans desperately need because, you know, they have food problems. They have economic problems. They have lots of problems. The biggest problems, though, are the with the Japanese, is the generous foreign aid, because Japan has a large number of ethnic Koreans, and many of them are pro-North Korea, in part because a lot of them are descended from people from North Korea. But secondly, because the Japan still has a very active leftist political community, and throughout the Cold War, leftists felt that they were, on the side of the angels, as it were, especially, minorities, and Koreans are the biggest minority in Japan, which is not a very hospitable environment for any kind of minority. And they basically sent a lot of money and other stuff to North Korea. But it eventually came out that in the 70s and 80s, the North Koreans had, and the North Koreans eventually admitted this, they had kidnapped 13 Japanese. They had sent people ashore, commandos, just grabbed, you know, Japanese citizens and took them back and basically used them to train, you know, spies and operatives in general who might be used to infiltrate Japan. Now, these kidnapped Japanese were allowed to, if they cooperated, you know, apparently all but one of, I believe, them did, they were allowed to get married. Married North Koreans, raised families and what have you. And the families of the kidnapped victims, you know, want to meet and see, you know, their kin, especially their children, you know, the grandnephews or grandchildren, whatever as the case may be, that were born in secret after their kin had mysteriously disappeared in the 70s and 80s. The North Koreans have been very coy about this. It took a lot of persuading to get them to admit that, they actually did it, but that's as far as they went. Japan basically was willing to resume foreign aid, but in 2010, when they came close to having another meeting, the Japanese pulled back because the North Koreans were making what the Japanese considered unreasonable demands. I mean, basically, the North Koreans are willing to sell whatever they got, be it information about, you know, kidnapped North Japanese or kidnapped South Koreans, for that matter, if the price is right. And, of course, they keep raising the price. I mean, it sounds like your classic greedy kidnapping, which is basically what they are. But the meeting in China, recent meeting in China, went well, at least to the point where they agreed to expand talks and hold another meeting, which by North Korean standards is a big move forward. But basically nothing is happening. And meanwhile, the big problem for North Korea is that their police state is falling apart. Now, this is important. A lot of people poo-poo predictions that, you know, North Korea is going to collapse if there's problems. Well, in some respects, this criticism is correct, but it misses the point. North Korea is one of the practitioners of the perfect police state. This is one of the few things the communists contributed, shall we say, to whatever, you know, world culture in the 20th century. The other thing they contributed was more effective methods of torture. Again, that's something most people don't want to talk about, much less the, you know, the former communist countries. But they did basically develop a methods for running a police state which were uncrackable. They were very difficult to get spies into, as we discovered throughout the Cold War. And North Korea was one of the better, you know, applications of these malign, you know, techniques, as it were. But there's one big flaw in this perfect police state, in that they trashed the economy. I mean, they basically depended upon a command economy. That was the foundation of Soviet economic policy. And this economy eventually runs down the economy overall to the point where it is literally bankrupt. And that's why all the Eastern European communist states and the Soviet Union itself collapsed between 1889 and 1991. Now, this was a big shock to the Cubans, to the North Koreans in particular, and so the Vietnamese and, you know, the few remaining communist states. The North Koreans, despite their best efforts, their police state is cracking and falling apart. And what we reported yesterday in the strategy page was some of the latest intel. For example, the thing that the North Koreans are most afraid of is the fact that more and more information about the outside world is getting into North Korea. Now, one reason the North Koreans were so efficient at running their police state was because they kept information about the outside world out. You know, until the Great Famine of 1990s, you know, after the Cold War ended and Russia cut off its economic aid, which had been basically keeping the North Koreans afloat for decades, things got very bad, and North Koreans, even though they had been brainwashed very effectively into believing that they were living in the workers' paradise, I mean, several million people died of starvation. and you couldn't hide this. And more people began fleeing, those who survived the process, into China, because they were desperate, either get out or die, as many who didn't get out did do. And information began getting back into North Korea, because North Korea always had a policy of trading with China. China was always North Korea's major trading partner. I mean, North Korea had things to trade. They were, during the Japanese occupation from, you know, 1910 to 1945, Japan basically industrialized Korea, and most of that industrialization was in the north. The south was basically always more agricultural, and the Japan turned that into a breadbasket, as it were, for Japan, not for Korea. These economic improvements, which were not bombed, not damaged a lot during the war, continued to thrive, you know, after World War II. And, you know, until the 80s, the standard of living was actually higher in North Korea than in South Korea. But then it rapidly changed because, you know, South Korea got going on its industrialization, and they rapidly eclipsed. So two very bad things happened for North Koreans at the same time. One, South Korea became much more prosperous, and North Korea became much less prosperous, again, because of the cutoff of the Soviet foreign aid, which included food as well as industrial equipment and what have you. Again, that happened because Russia, Soviet Union was fell apart and it was bankrupt. It couldn't afford to send anything more to North Korea. The that information infiltration, as it were, is seen by the North Korean leadership as a deadly virus. That, if anything's going to kill them, it's going to be that. And the North Koreans have carefully studied what happened in Eastern Europe, where all those states collapsed almost simultaneously. And they saw basically it was knowledge among the people of the greater prosperity in Western Europe. So long, I mean, decades, I mean, for a while, the communist dictators could say, look, our method is superior, give it time. Well, after 3 decades, you know, the Eastern Europeans realized, well, way the hell behind, you know, the people in Western Europe, and we're not getting any better. And so people just said no more. Now, this is what the North Koreans are afraid of. And now what they have done is very reluctantly accepted Chinese advice to do what the Chinese did. Chinese were facing the same problem. And even before the collapses in 1989, China decreed that capitalism is okay, or as the translation of the Chinese phrase was, it's glorious to get rich. And the Chinese said, okay, baby, and off they went. And, of course, they're still going, as we well know, in the West. The problem was that the North Koreans do not believe that they can hang on to power as the Chinese Communist Party did if the people are allowed to get too wealthy. But they can't stop it. For example, this spring, much to everyone's surprise, the North Korean government quietly allowed, or basically encouraged, institutions, you know, factories and what have you, to lease their farmland to private farmers. Now, this is shocking, you know, for North Korea. Now, the reason they do that is because, again, this is a communist custom. All factories and, you know, commercial enterprises, what have you, have been allocated farmland long ago and told farm it. You know, in other words, supply a portion of your own food. Even the army does this. Apparently, the army's not leasing out its land, but they're probably next. Anyway, because they're doing this because they've noted that free farmers are a lot more productive than people working on state farms. Well, surprise, surprise. Again, that's something the Chinese could have told them, or North Koreans visiting China could have seen. It was happening right across the border. You got these prosperous farms, often run by ethnic Koreans. There's millions of ethnic Koreans living in northeast China, always have been. And so there's no keeping it secret. So the North Korean government said, okay, we'll do it. But at the same time, and this is tragicomic in many ways, they decreed that prices in the legal markets, in other words, they've legalized a lot of the black markets, which have always been around, and this is basically where most people get their food these days. They told that issued rules, and people have been told that the prices in those markets are state secrets. In other words, you go to prison camp or get executed if you tell foreigners, you know, what the price of rice is in your local market. Now, Westerners will say, wow. But the problem is that the government, again, thought it was losing control of the food supply. Because, again, it's impossible to miss the fact that most North Koreans are getting their food from these private markets. The prices are competitive, in fact, even cheaper than what the government was offering it for. The government is no longer giving out free food like they used to for decades. And you either go to the market and get it or you starve. The prices fluctuate. The government has tried to keep prices down by basically emptying the food reserves. This means the army no longer has the big food reserve it used to have. It's gotten so bad in the army that troops, you know, especially non-elite units, for the last few years have been put on short rations. In other words, only two meals a day, and basically told to farm harder, as it were, on the farmland that each unit is allocated. The troops have not been happy about this. And again, this gets out because all these people legally going to China to trade or on business or what have you. The North Koreans have to find food. They're not getting it from the foreign aid because one reason a lot of the foreign aid from South Korea and Japan was cut off because they found out, again, because of the information leakage into China, was that a lot of this food aid was basically being taken by the government and sold on the markets, often shipped across into China and sold. They didn't bother to repackage a lot of it. And it was pretty obvious, you know, a gift of Korea, as it were, on a big sack, a 50-kilo sack of rice, is a pretty, blatant giveaway. North Koreans refused to allow the aid groups to personally have foreigners, basically give out the rice. Now, this is something that aid organizations do in many countries where corruption is endemic. The North Koreans, however, said, no, we'd rather starve. Well, that's what they're doing. So now they're spinning their wheels, trying to make nice to South Korea and Japan to get the food aid. But the big stumbling point is they will not, and they probably will eventually give in on this, they will not allow the aid groups to go and give out the food. Now, one thing they were afraid of for a long time was that these farmers, these foreign aid workers, many of them are employed by the UN, would find out just how bad off many people in North Korea were because their security was so tight. Again, the police state tactics was that, you know, much of North Korea had not been seen by foreigners for decades. But again, technology changed this. Google Maps, Google Earth, I should say, and other similar services have now been showing, you know, high quality satellite imagery of what it's like on the ground. And private individuals, I mean, CIA has been doing this for years, but there are tools, again, used by government agricultural enterprises to basically measure, you know, how the crops are going in a large area. Again, this is nothing new. This has been going on, you know, even before space satellites. You just do it from an aircraft. They could see that North Korea was not producing enough food to feed everybody. The North Koreans don't want to basically live with the fact, accept the fact that the foreigners already know how bad off we are. And maybe it's just as well that, okay, we don't make that extra money from selling off the food aid. We feed the people. So you've got a real conundrum. I mean, the leadership is I can't think of a better word than perverse. They're desperately afraid of not only losing power, but losing their lives because, you know, they sense that there might be revenge. I mean, the Eastern European country they paid the closest attention to was Romania, where the Ceausescu's, the ruling family, like the Kims, was very much hated by the population. Even though many North Koreans worship the Kims, that has been deteriorating, and it's obvious because you're seeing more anti-Kim graffiti. Now, that was unheard of, you know, a decade ago. But now, even though you can be executed for getting caught, you know, saying, you know, Kim was a schmuck or whatever, you know, it sounds better in Korean. making all sorts of jokes about, you know, our teenage, you know, leader, which is a big insult because in Asia they respect, you know, you're not really qualified to be a leadership until you're eligible for, you'd be eligible for Social Security in the West. Yet they got this 30-year-old kid running the country. And that's why, for example, he approved of the 2010, you know, shelling of the island and the torpedoing of the submarine, which externally they had denied they had anything to do with. But as Austin pointed out, they had the forensic evidence, which basically brought up components of the torpedo that, you know, doesn't completely destroy itself. And they basically brought the ship up and they basically scoured the, you know, the ship and the surrounding seabed, because it was relatively shallow water, and they reassembled the torpedo, and surprise, surprise, it was a North Korean torpedo. Again, the North Koreans denied everything, but internally, again, this got out into China. They were spreading the story that, yes, we did it, and, but, you know, we've got to keep it quiet because, you know, they might bomb us, et cetera, et cetera. So all of their usual techniques, the ones that worked so well for decades to keep people under control, are weakening. And what scares them the most, the leadership the most, is that despite, you know, several fumbles managing the currency and what have you and trying to, you know, keep the wealth of these, this entrepreneur class, which, again, they depend on to feed the people now. these people are still getting rich, and they're building homes. You know, it used to be the big deal in North Korea was if you get yourself an apartment. The government would build these apartment blocks, and favored people would get the apartments. But now these entrepreneurs are wealthy enough, they're building homes in suburbs. And the government is afraid to stop this because every time they stomp on the entrepreneurs, they've tried it a couple times in the last decade, suddenly there's no food for the people. You know, they shut down the markets, the entrepreneurs basically get scared. You know, capital flight, as where the capital doesn't flee the country, just gets buried somewhere until the entrepreneurs feel it's safe, you know, to go back to trading again. So the North Korean government, you know, is trying very hard to regain control. Another example of that that we reported was they've begun telling people who are legally visiting, you know, China, that if they provide credible information on someone who has illegally gotten out and is living in China, they get a get out of jail free card. Well, I mean, they described it as favors, but what I got when I made inquiries, it means if they catch you for some economic crime, you don't get executed, or we're even, you know, give up, you know, squeal on somebody that, you know, somebody else, and you'll be free again. So they're basically doing whatever they can do. Oh, by the way, in China, northern China, with Chinese permission, the North Koreans are allowed to have a certain number of their own secret police. Again, looking for what they describe as criminals, but it's basically anybody who's gotten out and they could grab and bring back. And so getting what they describe as, you know, credible information on a defector means the local North Korean secret police, usually accompanied by Chinese police, will grab them and drag them back into North Korea and kill them. They're doing whatever they can to stop this illegal, you know, exodus from the country. They've slowed it down a bit, but basically people are A, aware of how screwed they are, and B, aware that one way out, if you can't, you know, become an entrepreneur inside of North Korea, just, you know, escape. They tightened up security at the border. They have special secret police units that they rotate because if they stay there too long, they get corrupted. Basically, keeping an eye on the regular border guards who can be bribed. Now it's more expensive because if they catch some border guard taking a bribe, they'll kill them. But people in North Korea have become tough. You know, as the old saying goes, "What doesn't kill me makes me stronger." So losing your life getting out of the country is seen as a reasonable risk for many North Koreans. Paying a larger bribe to get out, well, hey, the cost of doing business, the cost of saving your life. And they don't see any solution, you know, good solution. They're basically just treading water, paddling as fast as they can just to keep their heads above water. And that's why we keep saying, you know, that, you know, the end is nigh, you know, and we're not talking about the end of the world. We're just talking about a police state which is crumbling before our very eyes. And eventually it crumbles to the, you know, point where it just all comes down.
Austin, how are the South Koreans going to react to all of this? You seem to indicate in your piece that they may be getting more aggressive in their reactions to the North Koreans.
Well, the hope, and that's what it was, and even there were some of the naysayers that said it wouldn't work, that secretly admit, gee, if it does work, I'm referring to the sunshine policy, won't we all be better off? And it held out some thin, frail possibility that the elements within the Kim regime would recognize that they had indeed lost the economic, social, cultural, political, well, every dimension of the Korean War, with the exception of the military dimension, which is still unresolved, which is why we're talking about it, why those rounds were fired at the end of March into the sea. There was hope that it just might work, that you might show elements, people, some group with some leverage, if not leverage now, leverage later, in later years, that war was not the solution, but it all but guaranteed North Korea's own demise. But continued belligerence, 2010, those two incidents that Jim and I both discussed. And by the way, Jim's got a pretty good write-up. I mean, we've got numerous detailed write-ups, but let's say a retrospective on it in that piece he put up this week on Strategy Page, when he goes into the more details about the analyzing the sinking of the of the Chonon. That was a big deal, Dan, a very, very big deal. Now, there's some polling evidence for this, but I myself heard this in anecdotal evidence when I was in South Korea, and then also reading, as I do, in the South Korean press. A lot of the younger, so-called millennial generation, the 20-somethings, early 30-somethings. And remember, Kim Jong-un is 31, isn't that right, Jim? He's 31? You said, I think, he's in his early 30s. South Korean side, there's some leftist and peacenik components within the South Korean body politics. Some of them end up in the universities, and then, maybe this is all going to work out. Well, 2010 was an illustration that the Korean War really is not over, and a lot of young South Koreans saw that. Whether they like it or not, those guys up north are going to shoot at us, try to intimidate us and extort money from us, and their biggest threat is they're going to destroy Seoul and the entire Seoul region, which is one of the most economically productive regions on the entire planet, with nuclear weapons. So what are we going to do? Capitulate to what, as Jim's described, a completely failed totalitarian system? Or are we going to defend ourselves? And part of this the response, too, is the former president reinvigorated what had been a policy, which is that we're going to have a fund. He actually formally created a future Korea unification fund, which just upset Pyongyang and North Korea and the Kim regime immensely, because South Korea, one of their concerns was that if you thought East Germany was bad and West Germany had to rebuild them, and it took 12 to 15 years for the German economy to reabsorb reunification, my goodness, North Korea will be a huge multi-decade rebuilding process, and it would come out of South Korea's pockets. And South Korea's built itself has a material first world economy, Dan. I mean, you can see it when you travel around the peninsula. Yeah, it's got pockets of poverty as everyone else does, but it's a huge, huge economic success story. So what I'm giving you is the political and social components of why, hey, we're not putting up with it anymore. You guys want to shoot? We'll shoot back. We've invested in our military. We're modernizing it. Jim's talked and written a great deal about that. And so now it's very structured. What was done with a shoot back? It's not the first time South Koreans have shot back. they've done that in the past. But as Jim in his analysis this week points out, the South Koreans have done made some organizational communication changes and changes in the authority level of local commanders to shoot back. And it's you see it land in your area. I'm not sure at what command level the decision is made. I'm going to guess division commander. It's possible the division artillery commander had say. I think it might maybe the corps army commander, but it's you don't have to go all the way back to the highest political echelons to get okay to shoot back. You're going to shoot back. And Jim covers that in what he wrote for strategy page this week. So, bottom line, is it popular? I don't know that popular is the right for South Korea, popular, but it is they're resigned to it, and you can understand it's an angry resignation, Dan, if I was going to put a passion on it, and it's also a confident resignation. If we're going to fight, we like our odds, we like our allies, and the South Koreans also have ire now too for China. Half dozen commentaries I read in various South Korean publications earlier this week is the same line that they've had for really the last 20-25 years, but it was emphatic. China's got to do something. China has to get active about this threat. And Jim and I both written about the economic ties between mainland China and South Korea and Japan. They're very real, but they all benefit from it. The loser in this is the willful loser, and that's North Korea. So I guess if I was going to sum it up, North Koreans have lost everything except the military dimension, and you know they're after a nuclear weapon because that's the only thing that's worked for them. And I don't know. I think Jim's discourse on the situation in North Korea is not only detailed, but how could you be more full, more complete in describing an utterly failed police state, totalitarian police state? I guess that sum it up, Jim. I mean, sheesh.
Jim, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Jim, on the Chinese side, it seems like the Chinese just want this to go away. That
China has finally responded to Western American demands that they put some pressure on the North Koreans. And the thing that hurt them the most, the North Koreans the most, is China basically withdrew its permission for North Korea to run its arms smuggling operations through China. Because for years, what the North Koreans could do was they could ship goods, you know, smuggled goods coming in or out via train into China and then put them on a Chinese or foreign ship in a container, you know, with false documentation saying it was something else and ship it off. The Chinese basically said no more. And this hurt North Korea big time because this was a major source of foreign currency, which they need to buy goodies to keep the elite, you know, the upper ruling class, as it were, happy. And they've also basically told them that they're going to cut economic aid in terms of investment if the North Koreans don't get the corruption in line. Because what the North Koreans were doing, and this sounds incredibly stupid, but you know, I couldn't believe it. I had this several times go back to South Korea and say, did this really happen? The North Koreans would basically abuse the Chinese investors. You know, Chinese firm would come in, spend a couple billion dollars to open up a tungsten mine, you know, some new mine and what have you. Most of the output would go to China, but China was paying market price, you know, for that ore, and it was a bonanza for North Korea. And North Korea is basically trying to screw the company, in some cases seizing things, literally just stealing things. They also would do that with the Chinese government. The Chinese railroads are state, you know, control, And there was one incident where some North Korean officials said, well, let's just steal a couple of these Chinese trains. You know, we could use these locomotives and rail cars. So we'll just disappear them and repaint them and what have you. Well, the Chinese basically had long since lost any, you know, sympathy for the North Koreans. And the screaming got reached all the way to the top in China. And the orders went all the way back down to North Korea, give back the cars or we're really going to get angry. And that's why the title of this week's piece on Korea was It's Not a Good Time to Poke the Dragon. Because basically the North Koreans have taken that warning to heart and they are trying to make nice to the Chinese. Now, how far they'll go remains to be seen. They're doing a lot of symbolic things, like finally talking to the Japanese. They've basically allowed reunions with your family separated by the Korean War. This is all, it's important for the families involved. There's no denying that. But in the grand scheme of things, it's small stuff. They have to do something really impressive, like allow more economic opening, as it were, which apparently they are doing. I mean, with the surprise business of leasing farmland, state-controlled farmland out to private, in effect, private individuals, entrepreneurs, to run as for-profit farms, that's unprecedented. Now, there's a lot of resistance to that in North Korea because there are a lot of old-timers who say, look, we lose everything if we lose control. I mean, there really is a palpable sense of doom, if they lose power. Because they're, again, looking at what happens in the Ceausescu's in Romania. They know what they've done. And, for example, China did go to bat for North Korea when the UN released their report basically accusing the North Koreans of war crimes for their prison camp system. Now, these are nasty stuff. This is the gulag, old Stalinist-era gulag where, good for 30, 40% of the people sentenced there would never survive, serving their sentence to come out alive. The North Koreans went through the motions of shutting some down, but they opened up new ones. So they try to play these games even with their closest allies, their only ally, which is China. And the Chinese have, and the State Department has quietly thanked the Chinese for this, the Chinese have basically said, look, no more nice, Mr. Nice Guy. We're getting serious here. And that's the last thing the North Koreans want to hear. So the problem is there are too many things the North Korean leadership is seeing or hearing that is the last thing they want to see or hear. So, doomsday has been coming for decades. Yes, I know. But it's getting damn close.
Right. Well, we'll leave it at that and talk to you next time.